I am delighted to be here today with Tomer Solomon. And I have a little secret. The only thing I know about Tomer Solomon is what I've seen on Twitter, and then what Tomer sent me by email as we were preparing for this conversation. I just love the way your mind works, Tomer. And there's three things I want to talk about, so I can tell already we're going to want to talk more than once. The first thing is a Substack you just put out on cosmic Bayesian inference, which I think is just, I haven't read the whole thing yet because I didn't have time before we got on here, but I think it's just brilliant. And then the second thing is an article you did on beauty. That just blew my mind because for 4 years on this channel, I've been telling people, I don't know how to put this into words. And then you put it into words. So, okay. And then the third thing is you did a massive paper on a unified process theory of meaning, which I'm not even a fourth of the way through yet, but it's just a really, really thrilling thing to read. So I am looking forward to getting to know you, and I want my audience to know you. So I wonder if you could first introduce yourself a little bit, and then we'll start to break this down. I have some questions for you.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for that really sweet introduction. This is my my first public interview, I guess you can call it. So really excited to engage in this conversation. And I think it's so special when, you know, you find like-minded people on the internet and you share similar interests and can dive deeper. You know, there are a lot of things to critique about modernity, which I'm sure we'll get into. But the benefit of modernity is connecting with like-minded folks. So thank you for that sweet introduction. A little bit about me, yeah, where to start.
Maybe start a little bit. First of all, what do you do? But then back it up and tell me how you grew up and how you got interested in the thing that you do.
Yeah, excellent. So I'll start maybe from the very beginning to give some context and then build up to you know, today. But yeah, I grew up in California, in San Diego. My parents are originally from Romania. You know, very much am a product of the immigrant mentality and the American dream. So they grew up in Romania. I was born in Israel and then ended up growing up in San Diego, California. And I mean, in retrospect, a phenomenal place to grow up. You don't really realize that until you experience your first New York City winter, and then realize, what am I doing here on the East Coast? But yeah, growing up, I was always interested in math and science. That was my background growing up. But always a math and science kid. In high school, did research in astrophysics. Did research some research in biology. And yeah, loved the rigor and beauty that math provided to think about how to, you know, understand the world. For college, I ended up going to school at Columbia here in New York. I'm based out in Brooklyn right now, with the intent of doing science research. So I ended up going out to school out east, wanted a little bit of a different experience compared to California, and was interested in a couple of different things. My interests early on were in computational neuroscience. So I was really interested in, yeah, bringing the rigor of neuroscience, or the rigor of mathematics, to understand how the brain worked. And so early in my research career, I was focused on this type of work. You know, lo and behold, spent some time in New York and the siren songs of finance called to me. You know, in undergrad, I ended up putting away, I say, you know, I put away the Python notebooks and, you know, the musings on the brain, and substituted them for discounted cash flow analyses. So it ended up.
Does that mean you're a quant, or what do they call them? A quant or a.
So my first job out of college was in M&A investment banking. So
for people who don't know, that's merger and acquisition, right?
Exactly. So I've always been super intellectually curious, but the siren songs of finance and consulting are a little bit too strong. And actually, one of the reasons why I started this work that we'll discuss is that I always found it like I had the question, like, why are some of the brightest minds of our generation going into, finance and consulting roles? And I think, it's we'll get into, we can get into to some of this stuff too, but it was one of these musings. And, it's very easy to have a bit of an existential dilemma when you're working at 2 a.m. staring in front of an Excel spreadsheet, being like, why am I doing this? Really feeling the embodiment of a cog in the wheel. And, some people just deal with it. And I, being a little bit more curious, I was like, what is this feeling, right? And what's why how have we gotten to a place in which I'm potentially aligning logos on presentations? And so it becomes a bit of a more holistic question, which is like, how do we get into this materialist reductionist paradigm, which is a bit of a broader conversation. But yeah, ended up for career starting up, doing finance, M&A, investment banking, and then went into technology, or doing M&A at a tech company, with the desire to be a little bit more mission driven, right? Like in Silicon Valley, there's this notion of techno-optimism, where there's an implicit assumption that technology leads to progress, which actually I'm a little bit critical of. But yeah, ended up joining a technology company doing the similar thing within in Silicon Valley. But even there, I felt some qualms, right? I on a professional level, I was lacking this meaning and fulfillment from work. And then even more broadly, there was a general feeling of cultural malaise for whatever shape or form. And so I was curious in exploring what exactly this feeling was.
Mean
And
a feeling in you or in the environment around you?
in me and in the environment around me, where I think people were often feeling disillusioned about, these career choices. And that kind of that personal and professional spark made me kind of reflect on what I ended up studying in undergrad, which was computational neuroscience. And the beauty of my undergrad education was also I had exposure to the Western canon. So at Columbia, you study the core curriculum, and I would have never done it actually if I was a math guy always. So you we it was brilliant because we had the opportunity to read, the entirety of the Western canon. We started reading with, Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, Divine Comedy, you name it. Like, there was a beautiful luxury to this experience. But when I read it as mandatory reading, I was like, oh, I have to read through it. But now, as a more active, thinker trying to solve my own problems, I almost felt that there was, there were answers that I could understand the questions that these folks were grappling with in a new way. So, these works came to life a little bit. So that was kind of my trajectory. Now I'm on a sabbatical, and it's been nice because I've been able to have a respite to think about things. And, one of the things that I've been thinking about, which is what is one of the most important problems to solve? Like, what do I think is worthwhile? Is it starting up a technology company? Is it, joining up a hedge fund, whatever it is? And I think the issue that we have is a cultural issue today, particularly about our relationship with technology and what it means to be human in modernity. And ultimately, I think the question that I was looking to answer is, yeah, what does it mean to be human in modernity? And the way I like to think about it is, we have, how do we bridge this material might that we've accumulated over the past couple centuries, through the powers of Newton and Newton and Descartes, with our philosophical maturity? And I think, the scientific enterprise that we've experienced in the modern world is a bit of a deviation in a world historically that has been seeped in enchantment, right? And so just thinking about how to reconcile this to ideally re-enchant the world, it's a bit of an ambitious mission, and think about how to integrate all these disparate elements, was kind of the the goal I had, which is how do we bridge this material might with philosophical maturity and cultivate wisdom in the modern world to live a meaningful life, to achieve eudaimonia, as Aristotle says, right? So this was kind of the high level picture that the problem that I was looking to solve, and then came across your interviews with folks, and found some unifying resonance with people that were thinking about similar ideas, which is always great to see. So yeah, that's a little bit of the premise, and then happy to kind of get into more specifics about what exactly this looks like, what my definition of meaning is, how I think about reconciling ancient and modern science and religion. There's a lot of different ways we can go, but happy to go out as you'd like.
Okay, so I think what I'd like to do is start with some questions that I had from the big paper that you put out on May 24th. You have a draft of it's called A Unified Process Theory of Meaning.
I'll make it public. I'll make it public as well.
Okay. Are
Yeah.
you hoping to like publish that on academia or something like that?
So yeah, I would say I'm a bit ex-cathedral at the moment, as a way I'm just kind of working on my own. What I'd like to do with this research work is, and through your help actually, potentially is socialize this with scholars in the space. And just stress test it, see where we can refine the thesis, see where there's holes, and see where, there's resonance. But I'd love to have this become part of a potential public discourse to, yeah, formalize the thesis a little bit more and ideally get the rigor of, academics on it. So, yeah.
Well, I would certainly love to work on trying to connect you with talking with some of these people. I have not had the opportunity to talk to Carl Friston with the Markov blanket thing, although I've talked about him an awful lot.
Yeah.
But I have talked with the people who have talked who talk with him a lot. And so it may be potential that I could put you two guys together, because I've thought ever since I ran into the Markov blanket idea that it scales way more than what they're even thinking that it scales.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, exactly. We can get into it, but I came across the Markov blankets because, I was trying to pick up where is the latest research that's happening in computational neuroscience. And I came across Carl Friston's work with the free energy principle. And I mean, I think that it was just a beautiful model. And obviously the Markov blankets is a way to formalize identity, essentially, right? To formalize the distinction between internal and external states. And I was listening to John Pagot's work on how on you can think about scaling identity in different ways, and I thought the Markov blanket formalism was a beautiful mathematical formalism to articulate this concept of identity, of being coupled with the environment but distinct from. And the way that Markov blanket formalisms work is that the interactions with the environment happen through these perception action loops. But
So before we go
yeah.
so far into that, it might be a good idea to I noticed, I think it was in your Substack, that
Yes.
you gave a great explanation of Markov blanket. So let me bring up your Substack and we can actually look at the illustrations, because there may be some people who aren't familiar with the whole Markov blanket idea. And let's see, that's the unified theory of meaning. Let me try this one.
I see the beauty in
Yeah.
it. I can show it to you as
Oh, I
well.
know, it's in your other article, which, where did I do? Yeah, what, if you have it handy, why don't you share it?
Let me share.
The Substack on cosmic Bayesian inference, because that had some beautiful illustrations.
Oh, wait. Do you see my. Oh, wait.
Yes, I do. There it
Oh,
is.
you do?
You were there for a second.
Some technical difficulties. Okay, yeah, let's walk through it. So the Markov blanket is a beautiful and simple mathematical formalism to articulate the relationship in computational neuroscience terms, with of the brain with its environment. So there's four key states. There's the internal states, which represents a generative model about the world, beliefs, and there's external states, and these are the raw, it's the raw environment behind beyond immediate perception.
Okay, let's simplify that down a little bit. The generative model of the world, that's the internal state,
Yes.
is based on our own DNA and our experience
Look at it
and the
more as.
picture that we have of the world
Yes.
and the predictions that we might make about the world based on that picture. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so it would be our personal order.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
then the external states would be the disorder that we confront on a moment by moment basis.
Exactly.
Okay.
You can think about internal states as pockets of order. Another analogy to think about it to make it a little bit more digestible is if you're playing a video game and you have that map in the corner, right? You have the internal state being the direct light of perception that you see on the map, and then the external states being, you know, the black unexplored area is potentially another analogy to think about it as well. And this mediation between internal and external states, which importantly is conditionally independent, as in there's no direct line between internal and external states, happens through a Markov blanket, which is basically intermediary states that help govern the mediation between internal and external states. So there's never any direct relationship between internal and external states, save through the Markov blanket.
Do you have a illustration on your paper of the Markov blanket just for people
This
who
is,
haven't seen it before?
yeah, this is, if you can see my screen, this is the
Well,
Markov.
there's another image of the Markov blanket though that shows the center. It's more like this one right here, where there's a center and then there's an external area around the center.
Yeah, and then the beauty about Markov blankets is that you can nest them together. So, you know, in the intellectual evolution, this is very similar to the Leibniz monad, actually, I think, which, but it's a more mathematical form, more mathematically formalized interpretation of the Leibniz monad, which was, you know, his articulation of the simple substance that made up the universe. And the beauty about the Markov blanket ontology is that you can represent every, you can wrap everything and anything in this atomic unit of a Markov blanket. So you can have nested Markov blankets within one another. And again, the intuition is similar to like cells, right? Cells, you can build cells upon one another, and you can wrap essentially the entire universe in this ontology, which becomes pretty interesting. And that's kind of this extension that we were talking about, which is in computational neuroscience, it's used to govern the brain's relationship with the environment. But if you were to extend it even more broadly, what are the implications and what is the power of it, I think, which is what we'll explore.
Yeah, I want to get into that because I do think there's one tiny hole in the free principle, free energy principle. And we'll talk about that, and then that's how it scales out. But let's go back again to the picture that you were working on. I didn't want to distract you from that because I think this is really important.
Yeah, so again, this for context is kind of just to get our bearings to understand what we're working with. But to reiterate, four states, internal and external, conditionally independent, right? There's no direct line between them. And the interactions between the internal state and the external state, an agent and its environment, is mediated through the Markov blanket, which is sensory states, which is the substate of external states that are perceived, and then active states, which represent actions taken. And so this is what we see here with these four circles, internal
So if
state.
I could simplify this way down for people, I'm Jordan Peterson right now, and I'm standing in front of a field of infinite possibility, which is going to occur in the next instant. And the way that I begin to navigate that field of possibility is my senses will come into being. I'll smell, or I'll hear, or I'll touch, or which tells me what's actually there, because all I have inside is a map of what's there, but then I my senses allow me to touch what's actually there. And if I make some sort of a discovery about that infinite field of possibilities, or that disorder that's out there, it's not disorder, it's possibility, it's filled with patterns probably, then I might take some action. If there's something in front of me that shouldn't be there, I'll push it out of the way. And now I can walk straight. That's my active state, acting on my environment so that I can change my environment to meet the need of the moment.
Exactly. And so what's the mandate of the internal state? And this is what the free energy articulates is, what's the goal of a self-organizing system? The goal of a self-organizing system is simply to persist through time. And what does this mean mathematically? This means to maintain your identity, right? Which is life. Maintain your local pocket of order. If your Markov blanket breaks, that can be equivalent to death. You lose your identity. And this can happen at any scales, right? And the beauty of Markov blankets is you can use them to understand cells. You can use them to understand your family, your communities, your friend groups. So again, they're really powerful. But what the free energy in particular mandates is to decrease uncertainty about your environment and then increase determinacy in a sense where you take actions to be aligned with with your model of the world and to decrease uncertainty. So what the free energy principle articulates is this through statistics. And I have a snippet in my other deck, which I can show you. The beauty too is that with the free energy principle, based on setting, we won't need to get into specific details and I'll come back because this is a bit of a tangent, but I just want to articulate the power of it again, is based on setting different parameters in the free energy principle. There is equivalences between Newtonian mechanics, quantum mechanics, and dissipative systems, and then self-organizing system, Bayesian self-organizing systems too. So in one model, based on importantly this distinction between internal and external states, you get a full unified theory that really shows the power of mathematics. And I know, Karen, you are articulating your thoughts on David Bohm's work, the physicist, and it is a bit related too, because it is, there's this dynamic between internal and external states that is required for the mathematics to work. And I haven't really dove deep, but again, this bifurcation between internal and external, which is a formalization for identity, really brings in and unifies a lot of mathematics in a very elegant way.
Okay, so there's two things I want to say at this point. One of them is this morning I caught just a snippet of a discussion that Dennis Noble was having with Richard Dawkins. And Noble was explaining to Dawkins why his concept of the selfish gene simply doesn't fly. And Noble was making an illustration of how if the nucleus of the cell is the size of his fist, the boundary of the cell, and Noble, I believe, was in London at the time, probably London. He said the boundary of the cell would be on the outer edge of Scotland. So he said, this nucleus is the size of my fist, and yet the edge of the cell is that far away. But it somehow gets a signal from the outside world. So how can that be? And he said, here's what happens. And then he goes into this very complex description of what happens when the edge of the cell gets this outside signal. It starts a chemical response on the other side of the boundary of the cell, on the internal side of the boundary of the cell. But for that chemical response to get back to the nucleus requires like a railroad of tubulins that have to be constructed after the chemical signal begins, has to construct this railroad of tubulins to get to the center. It only takes a couple of seconds, I guess. It sounded like he said seconds. But it's a very complicated process, and none of that can take place without an entire cell. So
Yeah.
all of the equipment for communication requires a living cell that's already in place. And this is true, obviously, of other things that have to do with this whole Bayesian inference idea that there has to be an internal model of the world before a living thing can interact with the world, but that living model of the world has to precede. So I mean, there's a lot of mystery involved in that whole thing. So that's one thing I wanted to bring up. The other thing I wanted to bring up is, to me, the kind of hole in this idea of the only goal of any entity is to persist through time, and trying to minimize uncertainty. Where does sacrifice fit in all that? Because sacrifice is something that starts at the very bottom and goes all the way to the top.
I have a good answer for you for that. And so I was thinking about the same thing, right? Like, to persist simplifies things a little bit, right? I mean, to use theology terms, where does the concept of salvation come in too, right? In this case. And so we can understand this via nested hierarchical Markov blankets, where there's two tendencies within Markov blankets. There's the self-assertive tendency, which is to maintain your existing Markov blanket. And then there's the tendency to strive for integrated wholeness, essentially. I actually have here. And we can open this up, but basically,
There you have it. You have sacrifice right
yeah, because
there.
I thought about it as well. So basically, the self I'll read it out loud. The self-evidencing dynamics of autonomous organizations can therefore be cast as exhibiting two different yet complementary tendencies. One, an integrative tendency of a multiplicity of Markov blankets to self-organize into coherent, self-evidencing whole. And then two, a self-assertive tendency to preserve individual autonomy. So what sacrifice is the identification with the larger Markov blanket, which is similar to our concept of identifying with an identity that is larger than yourself. And so sacrifice becomes the process of giving up the short-term self-assertive tendency to integrate into a coherent self-evidencing whole by having the appropriate temporal depth in your generative model. And then what ends up happening if there is no self, if there is no concept of sacrifice, whether it's at the level of cells, whether it's at the level of bodies, or whether it's at the level of civilizations, is that similar to cancer cells metastasizing, individual Markov blankets or individual metastasizing cells preserve their own identity at the expense of the coherent whole. And what does that happen? That leads to self-termination. And then this gets in the whole conversation about game theoretic approaches to self-terminating civilizations that you see when, in the work of Daniel Schmachtenberger and things like that at a societal scale. But yeah, that's the idea. And this let me know where you want to take this conversation, but this idea of identifying with the whole is a very key part of understanding what I propose is this it is this reimagined ancient metaphysics where the Neoplatonic idea of the what there was an initial unity, a wholeness to multiplicity, back to reintegrated wholeness becomes super important, right? That's this interplay between unity and multiplicity and this identification with the with wholeness. And what I define in my other paper is what does it mean to be good? What goodness is, whether it's through Adam and Eve, through their progeny in biblical narrative, is this very identification with unity and wholeness, right? So basic, and what we're facing today is we have no, unity. And so I think one of the important cultural problems to solve is how do we, reimagine this common humanity? But again, I'm going a lot of different ways, but hopefully that articulates your direct question with regards to how to deal with sacrifice. And I'd love to parlay it with even a broader conversation about what does this interplay between unity and multiplicity look like, which I articulate in the other paper that I'm working on.
Yes, well, so let's switch to that. I want to share my screen because I've got a lot of underlining done in that paper. So let me do this. Your paper on beauty. And you can see that, right? It's in the center of my screen. So you said at the most fundamental level, beauty can be understood as arising from a particular balance struck between the harmonies of order and symmetry and the generative tensions of disorder and novelty. So I was struck, first of all, by the idea that it looks like you're comparing order and disorder and then comparing symmetry and novelty. So symmetry and novelty as being kind of a opposing ideas is kind of interesting to me. So could you explain why you put those two opposite each other?
I was more going for a rhetorical flair, to be honest, in this, but thinking about out loud, I guess to me, like symmetry makes sense with regards to order, right? Like the more symmetrical something is, the more you it's almost, if you think about new conservation of mass or energy, there's way they're almost ideas of order, right? You can express things very simply, and the more symmetric something is, the more order it has. Maybe we can take a specific example of crystals, for example, right? The crystal structure, there's a relationship between order and symmetry. On disorder and novelty, I think it's this idea of disorder and multiplicity. It creates differentiation, and this differentiation and manifestation of different types of multiplicity and particularization leads to novelty, right? It leads to new, potentially new, whether it's in music, new harmonies, or whether whatever, I guess, medium. But that, I think, is this idea of, too much order and too much regularity. And I write it right here. There's it's too monotonous, right? Like we have a drive to be able to distill and, cohere to certain patterns, whether it's in music, I think is the most tangible example. But then obviously, if there's too much chaos, then you can't perceive any patterns within the noise. So this, I think, was the idea that I was more in a rhetorical flair with this specific sentence, but this was the interplay that I was looking to get at.
Well, I really like the general idea of this because the way that I started in all of this is that I had this experience of painting. Not that my work is beautiful or majestic or anything like that, but the experience of painting is a certain experience. And because I played with a lot of different materials and a lot of different substrates, I discovered that there is a certain way of painting where you can have a substrate that provides just continuous novelty as you're working. There's some substrates that are kind of slippery. And then if you're using water-based paints, the paint just kind of moves all over the surface as you're working. And you have to work very, very fast to capture anything on this surface. And so as this process is happening, I'm conscious of what my mind is doing in trying to bring all of these kind of disordered patterns that I see on the surface, bringing them into something that has a coherence to it. And it is like that. It's like you're trying to find the balance between this picture that's in your mind, which you might call the harmonies of order and symmetry, and then these things that are happening on the substrate and with the materials are kind of like generative in themselves because the fact that they're moving and that all of this opportunity arises as you're working. So it's between the original idea that you have and then these opportunities that arise. So if I had started out with, say, a blank canvas and a photograph, and I'm going to recreate that photograph on the canvas, I make each stroke intentionally to copy that photograph. But that's all I get then at the end is the photograph. But if I work in this chaotic environment, what I get at the end is so much more interesting to me and exciting, and in many ways, in my mind at least, more beautiful than what I would have had if I had simply copied the photograph, like verbatim.
How do you think about it in that similar exploration of creativity? How do you think about constraint in that regards too? Because there is also a relationship between constraints and novelty as well. So let's say you're painting, and I see you're a very talented artist, by the way. I think you were being a little bit humble with your remark. But for example, in the art, in the paintings that you have in the background, you chose a certain subset of colors, and you were also constrained to a canvas, right? So you could almost argue that to generate novelty requires constraint, and it's a bit
I've been
different.
arguing that for 4 years, Tomer.
Yeah, right.
That's
Because
one of the basic things that I think is fundamental to, I think it's fundamental to the universe. Well, and
exactly.
it's an old trope, right? That necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
And when the tighter your constraints, the more creativity can come out of it. So I took this class. I actually ended up taking it 8 times. Which was strictly the reason I took it is that the instructor put such tight constraints on us
Yeah.
that we didn't have very many choices. We had to paint the same thing twice a week for 10 weeks. So we had 20 paintings all painted of the same thing. And the same thing had to be in the same location on the substrate, and they had to be the same size. And after that, you could do what you wanted. But obviously, if you are trying to create something artistic and compelling, there are certain principles that you need to look at. And like one of those principles would be to find a group of either harmonious or contrasting colors and then stick within that palette for that particular painting. And then do you want that painting to focus on? You can't put all the principles in the front on every painting. So you want to focus on one or two. Maybe this painting is going to be really driven by line. This painting is going to be really driven by shape. This other painting is going to be driven by, very strong value contrast. Or maybe another painting is going to be driven by beautiful, harmonious colors that are very close. But
Yeah.
once you set that concept, then to stay within that concept is a very tight restraint. And then that forces you to think, well, what next? What
Yeah.
if? And all of that, I never knew that I was a creative person until I got into that environment where those constraints were so tight. And then this creativity just started generating inside of me. Probably the second time I took that class, if I had continued beyond the class, I could have painted 100 paintings of the same thing. And I would have never run out of ideas. The
Yeah.
ideas just kept coming.
Amazing. I mean, that's such a fast, yeah, that's so fascinating. Yeah. And I'm a strong believer too, where if, let's say, I mean, let's take the hypothetical. Let's say your canvas was infinite, right? Like there would be, what would you do, right? To even the simple, just like getting things on a canvas. And then of course you can further constrain yourself via color, via shape, via what you design to. For me, I was trying to learn how to figure draw. I was like, let's start very simple. Let's start with charcoal, figure, black and white, very simple. If I were to start with full spectrum of colors, I'd get lost. I'd get absolutely lost. Right? So you
You
can kind of.
get completely immobilized. If there's too many choices, well, and this is true in life too. If you have too many choices, you're just immobilized. You can't go forward.
Yeah. And then actually one of my favorite, if we're so yeah. So this concept of beauty was I was looking to interpret beauty through the lens of complexity. And I've been fascinated with this question of how does order emerge from chaos? I think it's just I mean, it's a question almost of cosmogony, I think it's like how does order emerge from chaos? But I initially approached it from the lens of complexity theory, given my background. And one of my favorite line from this mini essay was, and I think you may like it too, is art can therefore be, it's the last sentence, which is art.
Okay, well, that's also highlighted.
Art can therefore be interpreted as modeling reality's gendered process. A higher emanation allowing focused self-reflection by existence upon its own creative unfolding.
Okay, now I wanted to ask you about that because the way I read this, when I the first time I read it, I thought, huh, is he talking like you've read Ian McGilchrist?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so one of the things McGilchrist insists upon is that being, I think he's talking about being, that there is no actual being, it's all becoming. And that the universe is becoming self-reflecting on its existence by its own creative unfolding.
Yeah.
And that idea makes me very uncomfortable, because I do believe that there is God, however you're going to define God, that God is outside of time and space and fully complete. That
Yeah.
doesn't mean that you can be fully complete and still continue to grow. So, you know, I have no problem with that. But to say that God is not complete yet, or that he needs something to be complete, that I would feel very uncomfortable with that. But
Yeah.
when I read this the second time, I thought, oh, I think maybe what he's saying is that I, through seeing art and experiencing art, or maybe even doing art, that I come into awareness of this higher order emanation that allows me to self-reflect on my existence because I am creatively unfolding.
Yes, you are creating unfolding, and then that and the reason one of the reasons why art can resonate with you and is meaningful in some sort of way is it reflects some underlying metaphysics of, you know, whether it's the existence's creative unfolding or in your creative unfolding, your growth as well. There's a lot of different ways I want to go here. With regards to, let's take two, or let me articulate a couple of points. One, this idea of we are a way for the universe to know itself is echoes like Carl Sagan a little bit, you know, the publicist, where, you know, I think he has a line which just says we are a way for the universe to know itself. And then John Wheeler as well, the physicist, he has this idea of, you know, I think the self-observing universe. Have you seen like his work where he has this eye universe? And I think his intuition was a similar type of like, we are a way for the universe to know itself, which
well,
is.
And that almost sounds, the Wheeler thing sounds a little bit like Douglas Harding's Hierarchy of Heaven and Earth.
Oh, I'm not familiar with his work. I'll have to write that down. Yeah.
Well, with a mind like yours, you really ought to read it.
Okay,
It was,
yeah.
It was pointed towards me and I did my best. But it's really out there, but it's out there in a very interesting and kind of beautiful way. And the foreword is written by C.S. Lewis.
Oh, I mean.
He said he thought it was one of the most important books of the 20th century.
Okay.
So I would love to understand it, but
yeah.
Some of it is, I mean, it's all these patterns. Maybe I can find a copy of it in here.
Yeah, I'll take a look. And then the thing on God, which obviously is a very big question. Ian McGillicrist actually articulates his interpretation on it. And are you familiar with the concept of, I think it's panentheism, where.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I feel quite comfortable with panentheism.
Yeah, which is not, it's there's like pan, you know, pantheism, panexperientialism, and then there's this panentheism, which is the world is a subset of God in a sense. So,
well, I think more, it's more like pantheism, the whole world would be God.
Yes, that's
and
a Spinoza.
Is that God is outside the world, but then also in the world.
Yeah, I think about it like, yeah, it's like God is imminently transcendent and transcendently imminent or something.
Yes.
It's a beautiful symmetry. So.
And this is an interesting thought that might touch on the whole idea of the Markov blanket, is that there was this beautiful conversation between Roger Scruton when he was still alive and Jordan Peterson on the whole idea of transcendence. And Peterson said Transcendence is what you meet at the limits. The transcendence is what you meet when you err. When you come to the limits of your knowledge and you make a mistake because you've gone beyond the limits of your knowledge, that is where you meet transcendence. And that really resonated with me, with this whole idea of the boundary between the inside and the outside. And this idea of when you're navigating between order and disorder, and that's the creative zone. So
I'll have to share my screen because I have the exact I have the definition for transcendence.
Okay, we can come back to this other thing later.
Yeah, I know we're going along.
This is going to be a wild ride, I can tell already.
Yeah, there's a lot of places you go. So anytime you feel like I need to be reined in, you let me know. But yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this concept of transcendence as well, specifically like,
Can you expand that a little for people whose eyes aren't so good?
Yeah.
There we go. Okay.
Yeah. So what's this concept of transcendence? So Nietzsche has this concept of, you know, one of the core drives is this will to power, right? You know, we want to include power. And I was actually thinking, like, our core drive is actually the will to self-transcendence in a sense. And let me articulate what that means. Like, to provide some context, this is a section of my paper at the very end when I get into fun, lofty abstractions after I go through the thesis. But it's exactly what you articulated, Karen, which is, you know, self-transcendence is this inherent drive within all beings to reach beyond their current limitations and actualize ever greater levels of creative potential.
In alignment with eternal ideas. I've been hammering this idea of alignment for a long time.
Exactly.
You're really onto something here, Tomer. You're really onto something. And I love the way you write, by the way.
Yeah. So there's this concept of, yeah, like it's opening yourself up to and identifying with yourself with the whole that is larger than yourself, which goes back to this concept of identifying with a greater level of wholeness. And so, you know, we can get into the rest here, but you know, I'll call
well,
out
and,
this.
And what this goes back to too is this whole idea that Peterson talks about with that I maybe he got from Nietzsche, I don't know, and maybe it's his own thing, that the reason. So in Milton's Paradise Lost, that Satan is identified with the being that feels like it doesn't need anything outside of itself. It doesn't need any more knowledge because it knows everything.
The self-assertive tendency, right? Yeah. And what we're talking about with unfolding, like I probably identify mostly with Whitehead's thinking, actually how process and reality right here, that I'm working through. In the sense that like I like to think about, and I need to articulate, and this is more rhetorical, so beyond, you know, rigorously, you know, defining it, there's almost, and I'll get into it with the paper, there's this ongoing creative and open-ended evolutionary unfolding that's going on. And at its core, let me just read and articulate this, it's self-transcendent represents the universal impulse to open oneself to superpersonal currents, identifying with something transpersonal, and surrender subjective limitations to the objective imperatives of evolution. It's the quest for ever-expanding actualizations of integrated meaning through deepening attunement with the eternal verities that compose the essence of existence. And so it's identifying with this continuous it's this gender process of continuous growth. You know, I think the most beautiful way of saying it is like, a butterfly. Like a butterfly is a caterpillar, and then it goes into its cocoon, goes into its chaos, time-like chaos, and then self-transcends into a butterfly, right? And this is, of course, like a, you know, at the it's a very tip-top, you know, ideal, but it's this beautiful concept of the self-transcendence, this opening to, you know, ever-increasing wholeness, growth,
Well, the perfect thing about the butterfly illustration is that what actually happens when the caterpillar goes into the cocoon is that the entire caterpillar turns into goo,
Turns into it's chaos.
including the brain, everything. It just becomes
It's chaos, right?
so it has to completely die to self. It's almost like the shamanic tradition thing, completely dies to self, and then it's reborn into this new being, but that new being still has a memory. Whatever was, the training that the caterpillar received can still be realized by the butterfly, but it's realized in a completely new environment. A two-dimensional memory is realized in a three-dimensional environment.
And it's more complex too. It's more how could one define beauty? Arguably, one could define beauty as this diversity and unity. There's a lot of diversity in the color of the shapes of the body, the wing, right? But it's an integrated whole. And so what I articulate in this is there is an arrow of complexification. And so the universe seems to actually be tending towards increasing complexity, beauty. Internally, you can potentially define this consciousness, but that's a whole debate. And so there's this telos, underlying telos of the universe, which people like Bobby Azirian and Romance of Reality also articulate too.
So I noticed that you gave some credit to Bob Azarian.
Azarian.
Bobby. So who is he and what does he do?
Okay, so I bought his book. He had a book called The Romance of Reality. And he is a cognitive neuroscientist. And I saw him on the Active Inference podcast. And let's see if I can play it back live. But he articulates kind of this, he leverages and pieces together different thinkers in complexity theory to prove that essentially that there's this arrow of complexification that occurs throughout time. And he articulates this romantic idea, or this, yeah, he articulates this is in Romance of Reality. And I have a, I mean, similarly, but I also try and incorporate the biblical narrative into it as well. So I try and be a little bit more holistic. And I also try and integrate ancient metaphysics, like the traditional Plato and Aristotelian, to show that it's actually not as new as we think, because I think oftentimes we can have epistemic pride that we come up with new things, but in reality, like,
Oh yeah, I mean the whole idea of complexity and all that is, very, very old. So
So yeah, that's to jump to self-transcendence. But I know we're jumping. I know where we can go a lot of different ways. So let me know. I'm happy to paint the high-level picture of this thesis too, or go any direction you prefer.
I have some questions for you from this thesis. So let me ask these questions one by one. And now we can jump through the paper. So let's go to the beginning of the paper. I believe it's probably on page 2 or 3. You said, meaning manifests when the pattern of nature and the pattern of man match.
Yes.
And I would just like you to talk more about that because while I see what you're saying, I also want to throw in there, and you can talk about it. This probably fits, but Peterson says meaning precedes matter. And I think that's correct.
Meaning precedes matter.
Meaning precedes matter. So I'd like you to talk about whether or not that aligns with your idea that meaning manifests when the pattern of nature and the pattern of man match.
So yeah, okay. So in a sense, I'm going to leverage Matt Pagot's work through Language of Creation, where to me, meaning is the meat is it's this interaction of lowering meaning and raising matter in a sense. And so let's articulate it. What is meaning? We're on the meaning code, right? So this is the question to ask. And let me just take a step back and be a bit more rhetorical. But we've all thought about this question, like, what does it mean to live a meaningful life, right? A life that's rich, that has depth, that has tech, it's technicolor versus black and white, right? And I'm playful with it, but I'm like, is meaning 42 per Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, or is it discretized into some arbitrary fine structure constant? And I think in recent times, the debate has been whether meaning is an arbitrary cultural construct in a sense? Like, is it up to humans to discern and determine what meaning is based on cultural zeitgeists of the times? And my thesis and my hypothesis is, or can we even answer such an important question too, is that meaning is actually, and maybe this is what Jordan Peterson is articulating, is meaning is a fundamental feature of a teleological driven cosmos. And that may be what he means by meaning precedes matter, which is it is embedded in the telos of the purpose of the cosmos. And how I try and define it as simply as I could imagine, was meaning is when the pattern of man and the pattern of nature and the pattern of man meet.
Okay, so when you say that, are you saying, earlier you used this word alignment. I like that word very much. Is that what you're saying? Is that
Yes, exactly.
when a human being can come to that place where they align with the perfect teleological pattern that God
Exactly.
designed in the first place, that at that moment we feel meaning?
Exactly. Yeah, it represents the alignment between an entity's existential narrative and the transcendent archetypal patterns driving existence's evolution and unfolding. To use fancier language, when we're aligned with the underlying telos, which arguably, and which, is love, which is truth, which is beauty, which is goodness, right? I try and define which each one is. Goodness is the identification with wholeness. Beauty is this complexification process that occurs as diversity and unity increases. Truth is that which is invariant to time and space that always exists.
Truth is what?
I say truth is that which is invariant to time and space
Oh,
as
invariant. Okay, yes.
it's true. I mean, it's true, but it also has to persist throughout time. And yeah, I get a bit more rhetorical here, but I say meaning is the living fruit of resonance between man and nature, mind and cosmos, microcosm, macrocosm, myth and life story, or heaven and earth. And what meaning represents is when the story of one's life coheres with and personifies the deepest purposeful metaphysical currents and value gradients pervading the cosmos. Meaning signifies.
So on a more kind of pragmatic level, as a person is moving through life and they haven't had these moments yet that you're describing here, one of the ways that they might have a moment like that is upon being confronted with some beautiful painting or listening to a symphony. And Peterson is always talking about how all the parts of the symphony at a certain point come together, and you have this visceral sensation as you're listening to it, that there's something powerful and beautiful in this moment, then that's this your that your nature is aligning with the nature of the universe in that moment, because that artist has, in utilizing their the emanation that they touch upon as they're developing the music, they're always bringing the multiplicity and the diversity that's in front of them in the chaos into alignment with that emanation. And then that thing gets out there, and now if that other individuals can have that experience of relationship with that piece of beauty, right?
I mean, that is what a master artist or musician does, is captures that. I mean, for me, most recently, I just watched Dune 2, and that feeling afterwards of being like, wow. Or if you go to a symphony, right, and you listen to a beautiful symphony, and that feeling right afterwards where you're like, wow, something moved, something resonated into you. You take the lyre of Orpheus, right? It's like the lyre was strung. You're like, wow, that was so moving. That felt so meaningful. That felt so real. That felt so beautiful. And it is that feeling that is what I would argue like is meaningful, right? And the beauty is that feeling of meaning can also manifest itself not only in, after you watch a symphony or after you watch a masterpiece, but also in the day-to-day when you're going on a walk. And you see the beauty in the tree, or you see the beauty, you see the beauty in nature, Or it can also manifest in, the story of your life when, a love story, right? Like, that's the classic, the classic story in movies and TV shows. It's like, and the guy and the girl meet, right? So it's heaven and earth meeting in the sense. So meaning represents when heaven and earth meet, when the pattern of man and nature overlap, when microcosm reflects macrocosm. Again, all rhetorical in a sense. And then the question is, the philosophical question is, how do you put rigor behind it? And so the first step I do is simplify what meaning exactly is. It's when the pattern of nature and the pattern of man match. And then to do so, we have to understand what exactly is nature, right? And then we have to understand what exactly is man. And then we explore, and then we also have to articulate or explore when these patterns match. And that's what I look to do here. So for nature, I look to basically formulate our understanding of nature and science into a simplified model, recategorizing physics, chemistry, and biology into a seven-stage process theory, evoking the original Platonic and Aristotelian ideas to understand what the patterns are. And what you see is that there's an increase in complexification over time. There's an initial freedom and unity to multiplicity back to this reintegrated wholeness. And so I try and map out the science using a lot modern language you can understand and reframe it in the context of ancient metaphysics to recapture the depth in our metaphysical model, which I can articulate and get into. But oftentimes, the way they think about it from an Aristotelian perspective is our world of science technology is very much focused on efficient causes, how to create change. But we've lost the sense of what final cause is or purpose. And so reintegrating this depth of metaphysics between final, material, formal, and efficient causes, I think is what's missing in this day and age. And it is causing a flattening of our world in a sense. So how do we like, and that was one of the things I wanted to try and bring back. Then I said, and I'm happy to get into more detail, but let me just paint the high level thesis for you before we dive into anywhere you want to go. Then I said, how do we understand man? And this builds off the work that I initially was exploring with cosmic Bayesian inference, but I look to fold in what I call this theory of process based on Arthur Young's work from the Reflexive Universe to interpret the brain in light of these findings. And so I start with the free energy principle. And the free energy principle, well, there's a lot of details to get in here, so maybe I'll pause. But the free energy principle allows you to qualify the uncertainty at all the various levels. And then the Bayesian brain, what we end up seeing is that there's similarities between the Bayesian brain and our unified natural philosophy in the sense that feature vector, there's in the Bayesian brain, there's top down, there's a generative model and there's a recognition model. There's top down priors and then sense data, and they end up meeting. And so I was exploring these connections between process philosophy and the Bayesian brain. And then what I look to do is I look to explore when they found unifying resonance. And in particular, I came across the work of this individual, Michael Bull, who wrote this book called The Biblical Matrix. Are you familiar with it by any chance?
Michael
Bull,
Bull.
Bull. Yeah.
Michael Bull.
Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called The Biblical Matrix. But
I
what
have
he,
not run across it, but I will look it
oh,
up.
it's called Bible Matrix, excuse me. And so what he proposes, and again, I'll paint the high level points here and then happy to get into a bit more detail because I think it requires, seeing a variety of the different themes and then how they find resonance. But what Michael Bull articulates in his book is that the sevenfold structure we find in Genesis actually manifests in across the entirety of the work through the symbolism. The themes that we see in Genesis also are in the symbolism throughout the entirety of the book in a fractal-like way. And so, and also they're in the overarching literary architecture as well. And so, I mean, it's
Yes,
fascinating.
yes. And I mean, if you've read the Bible a number of times, that just falls out.
Okay, yeah, so
But it's exciting to see somebody take it and kind of systematize it and explain it.
yeah, so for me, like I grew up in, I would say, like a agnostic household. I had to take some Bible class. I had to take like, Hebrew scriptures and Christian scriptures in high school, and we read some parts in college, but I just recently picked up like the Bible again. And my initial perspective was like, these are just these are fragments of cultural and moral tales. And then I came across the work of John Pagot, who was absolutely brilliant in articulating like the wisdom behind the Bible. And then came across, Michael Bull's work, and the fact that there is an internally coherent fractal-like structure in the biblical works through the symbolism and through the literary architecture is fascinating. And then I
Now,
looked.
does he talk about chiastic structures in the poetry and
Exactly.
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I look to interpret that through the process philosophy. And then most creatively, I'd say, is that if you buy, and I'll have to give you the thesis, if I'll have to give you the rationale, if you buy that there's a relationship between the Bayesian brain and process philosophy, and if you buy that, of course, there's a metastructure in the biblical narrative that reflects this underlying organic and creative process, then is it possible to interpret the biblical narrative at a very high level through the lens of predictive processing? So similar to how Aquinas bridged Aristotelianism with Christianity, could you, in a rhetorical flair, say or interpret the biblical narrative as, through the lens of predictive processing? That is not to say that, that is not to distill the richness of the text, obviously, into numbers, but it is an interesting heuristic account to reinterpret it using the language of, mathematics, and providing a bridge for folks like myself that came from scientific and mathematical backgrounds. And I think, yeah, it's a fascinating expose. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I get even weirder, I think. I can totally see that, but I can also see the biblical narrative work. I can see the inner workings of the cell being a matrix that explores exactly the same issues because all these things scale. I mean, everything scales. And I think
Everything's still
if we
there.
look long enough at it, we're going to find that it scales all the way down to the particle level. You get down there in the quantum stuff, and there's going to be stories there too.
Exactly. And that's what I look to show is that the I think one of the issues that we have is there's a lot of fragmentation in the world, a lot of disunity, a lot of differentiation. And if we can, using the rigor of science and empiricism, show how there is things, there is an interconnectedness between mind and cosmos, man and nature. I think this instilling of this profound interconnectedness, even at just, a base, relationship to your day-to-day, really helps, cultivate a more beautiful and meaningful life. And then there's other ways we can do it too that are more pragmatic. Can we structure institutions using the latest understanding of complexity theory? Right. There's more pragmatic import as well, but I think it's just so fascinating, this bridge between modern and ancient, between science and religion. And one of the things that I always had in the back of my mind is like, is there even a world? Is there even a way in which we can bridge the two? And this is the attempts, the naive, ambitious, and most likely, like, there's probably some errors in it. But this is where the inspiration comes from. So.
Well, so are you giving the viewers carte blanche to call you on any errors that they find?
Please, I absolutely like this research is very preliminary. I am open to building in public. I read it right here, like, publishing in the spirit of building in public. Very much looking to engage in dialogue and discourse, in the spirit of, yeah, open communication and, the
Well,
pursuit
that's
of.
why I asked you if you had thought about publishing in academia.
Yeah.
I didn't mean academia as in the institution. I meant there is a publishing arm called academia where you
Oh.
can publish, and then people who like I get notifications from them all the time of new papers that have published, and then I could interact with people if I wanted to. It's completely free unless you want the second level of membership, and the second level allows you to see who's talking about you and your ideas and all that kind of thing. But I think anybody can publish on academia. I don't know, because I read a lot of really excellent papers, and then I read some papers that are kind of kooky. So I'm not exactly sure what the hoops are that you have to jump through to publish there, but it does provide you with an opportunity to get an audience that will interact with you on the paper, so that you're getting that feedback.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I mean, I'm hungry for feedback. I know that.
I'll send you a link to the academia publishing thing. And then I
Yeah.
want to get back to your 6 points here. Number
Yes.
four, you say process-based computational Christianity.
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance to read that part yet. What do you mean by that? Because I talk a lot about computational ideas, and so
Yeah.
I'd love to hear how you connect that up.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was more of a flare, if anything, but this is my potential interpretation, proof of concept, let's be very clear, with how do we leverage. Can we interpret the biblical narrative using the lens of complexity theory and predictive processing? And that's where I, and that's where and that's kind of that's where I get into. That's why I call it process-based
Okay,
computation.
so give us a little background on predictive processing.
Yes. So maybe it makes sense to jump into kind of these in a
We
little.
want to look at the Arthur Young thing first, because I think that
Yeah.
quite a lot of people on here are interested in Arthur Young, and this
Oh.
is a particularly nice illustration.
Yeah.
Again, make it bigger.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There you
So,
go. Okay.
yeah. So, this is the first time I'm articulating in this in public. So, I would appreciate any feedback on how I can make this.
And this is strictly Arthur Young's work right here, right?
Exactly. I want to be very clear. I put a footnote here. This is a synthesis of Young's work to set our foundation. I also write try and keep the middle school science regurgitation short, and then where I look to extend Young's work, I mean his work, if you haven't had a chance to read it, is brilliant. Like he basically is a modern Pythagoras. He takes a very mathematical approach to understand consciousness. So he has the reflexive universe, which is this. He has geometry and meaning. He has math, physics, and reality, and they're all really great. And the way he writes is extremely crisp too. And he proposes this process-based scientific paradigm off of Whitehead's work, actually. So yeah,
Have
he's
you run, just so I don't forget, have you run into George Adams' work on projective geometry?
so I remember we were treating, I think, an email about it. I haven't read it, and I haven't read the PDF you sent. Arthur Young talks about he relates some of his work to projective geometry and
Yes, yeah.
as well. But I'll have to
Okay,
take a look.
I'll send it to you. I'll send you another link.
Yeah, because he maps it out. Basically, the connection with projective geometry, and this won't do it justice, is that there's these seven postulates of projective geometry that you can use to describe things, and he maps each of the seven postulates to these seven levels. So he like uses geometry to provide rigor for why seven is the appropriate number for his process-based theory, to back it up a little bit more rigorously. So interesting. So yeah, let's go through this in some a little bit more detail. So this is it's hard to do justice to the entire past few centuries of science development, but the real goal here is there a way to leverage our understanding of science to create a heuristic account of what ancient metaphysics was looking to do with regards to understanding the difference between freedom and constraint, or we can say unity and multiplicity, indeterminacy versus determinancy. And I think this, to me, was one of the most tangible ways of helping with that bridge, using our modern language of science. So what Arthur Young does is in his book, The Reflexive Universe, and he provides a lot of empirically backed detail, is he proposes this sevenfold arc going with four different levels. The first level at the top here is max freedom, and then the bottom level here is max constraint. And so what we have are the main takeaways are we can call this move from freedom to constraint, involution, and we can call this move from constraint to reclaiming the freedom, evolution. You can get even fancier and say existential involution versus conscious evolution. With philosophy, we can say emanation versus emergence. You know, there's a lot of different ways to articulate this move. But the general idea we see here is that we start with light, which has, you know, the max amount of freedom. You can, Young says it's the atomic unit of action. And then it condenses slowly into matter through the subatomic particles, protons and electrons, to the atoms that we found on the periodic table. This is level three, to the molecules, the collection of atoms. And so this is the left side of the arc, what we can call involution, which is this condensation of light into the determinate structures of matter. And then, you know, interestingly, at level four, which represents max constraints, right? Max predictability, life kicks in. This concept of negentropy entropy kicks in. Obviously, this was explored through Schrodinger in his book, What is Life? Like, how does life come into existence? And so there's this important pivotal turn that happens at the fourth stage where the self-organization tendencies of negentropy kick in. And then the initial freedom that was lost on the descent down gets recaptured. And so for plants capture, you know, a sense of freedom because of their ability to reproduce, right? But they're still constrained. They need to go towards light and they can't move around. And animals, they capture further sense of freedom in the sense that they can move around, but they still need to eat food. And then humans, and again, these are heuristic accounts. That's not perfect, like, you know, X degrees versus X constraints, but it's more to get the sense of this recapturing of this initial freedom loss on the way down. And then, of course, humans have the max freedom to think, to leverage language and symbolic thinking to coordinate at larger scales, to develop counterfactuals. And essentially, what we can see is that the freedom that was lost on the way down gets, recaptured in a sense on the way up. And it's this beautiful synthesized symmetric model that is actually backed by a lot of the work of the original OG philosophers like Plato and Aristotle, and a very much and Pythagoras too, and it maps to their metaphysics. But this is this idea from unity to multiplicity, back to this reintegrated wholeness through our modern language of science is what we look to, is what we like, what was what we look to do here, establishing our metaphysical foundation.
So
I know that was a
the
lot.
human being is a wholeness integrated of, so what the scientists aren't looking at when they take everything apart down to the particles is that when they end up with all the particles and the molecules at the bottom, they don't have anything. But in reality, the wholeness is already there in the human being. Without the wholeness of the human being, we wouldn't be able to even look at the particles. So,
Yeah, there's this idea of I mean, there's this parts versus whole debate, right? And or not debate, of interplay, where I think I was exploring this on Twitter with you, where the part is actually a fractal reflection of the whole, right? And we see this in the biblical narrative too, where you have the first seven words of the Old Testament with, you know, the 7 days of Genesis with the seven, you know, with the seven first chapters of the Old Testament and then the seven entire chapters of the entire biblical story. But the part reflects the entirety of the whole and is a fractal reflection of the whole. But today, what we end up doing is we discretize and dice everything up into bits, right? Into very small bits. And we almost kind of, we disenchant things in a sense. And the issue with this, and this is what I look to provide a perspective on here, is that the issue with just focusing on level four, let's say, max constraint, which is the world we're in now, the world of efficient causes from Aristotle, is that while we have the power to manipulate, nature, and we have the strength, we lose the richness of the prior levels, right? We lose the purpose that is associated with the final cause in level one, or in Plato's Timaeus, he associates it with the element of fire, or with Pythagoras, he associates it with the concept of a point. And we lose this emergence and this holistic understanding of nature, that I think ends up creating a bit of a flatter world. And we kind of, I think it affects the way in which we approach nature, right? Which is in a less integral, less holistic fashion. So, even at the metaphysical, we have to drill down at the level of metaphysics to reclaim this sense of wholeness and this importance of wholeness and the whole versus the parts, because everything is actually in relationship to the whole, right? But today, especially in the world that we live in, there's a lot of diversity. But I love what John Pagot says. I think he's like, diversification without unity is just decay, right? So this instilling of the primacy of unity or wholeness, or what Plato says is the one, I think is so important. So this is what I look to try and do with this initial section, using the language of science, which is what we can hopefully all relate to.
That's a beautiful illustration, by the way, of the embryo.
Yeah.
Did you go looking for that, or had you seen that in something else?
Oh, this is Da Vinci's Da Vinci's illustration, and I was just trying to think about, I was like, is there a formal way to define creativity? I think creativity, one way, it's not the right way, but it's one potential way, is like, is birth of a newly integrated whole, to use our language of wholeness. So I thought like the human embryo was a good way of saying that. I mean, we can even like the paintings behind you, they're births of newly integrated wholes. Wholes that are separate from you, but still whole. I mean, we can even use more foam blankets too for up with that. That's another thing. So yeah, I had some fun with the pictures that were in here.
Well,
So
go back to the embryo thing, because there's something I wanted to, in that 2.6.4 paragraph, you say, in the progression from unstructured unity to increasing multiplicity and differentiation, have you listened to any of the episodes that I've done with Michael Levin?
Yeah, I have.
Okay.
Yeah, I
So,
have.
he always tells this story. He may not have done it on my channel, but on a lot of his other stuff, he tells this story about how we all start out as an unstructured oocyte, and that basically he's saying basically you can see the evolutionary progress of how we got to be human beings is we start out as this undifferentiated, basically he's saying an undifferentiated blob,
Yeah.
and then from there, we multiply into, multicellular organisms. And then from multicellular organisms, I don't know, somehow I guess that gathers up into organs, and then the organs gather up and somehow they create an outside body. I don't understand how he gets the whole thing as just being strictly evolutionary, because there's something more there, because that unstructured oocyte actually has everything in it that's needed for the human
Right.
being to be complete. I mean, the wholeness is there in the beginning, in the egg.
Yeah.
That wholeness is there.
Right.
And then
Right.
the wholeness is realized. So it's from wholeness to wholeness
Yes,
through
exactly.
parts, right?
Exactly. And there's a distinction, right? I think, right, the wholeness from the initial, it's both whole, it's wholeness, and then there's parts, and this is this evolutionary process of complexification. But what we get at the second wholeness is a greater level of diversity and unity, right?
Yes,
Human cells become great, become a collection of cells which become human, you know, which become body parts, which become humans, which become communities, which become civilizations, you name it. And there's this increase in diversity and unity, right, which manifests through this process. And this diversity and unity, you can say, is an era of complexification, to use some language of Desjardins, this Jesuit priest. Or the simplest is, like, it's just an increase in beauty. Like, the universe is striving towards increase in beauty over time. And it's, I mean, and that is the one of the fundamental, that's one of the telos I look to articulate. And I think Whitehead would call it, to connect it with his work, there's, like, I think it's like primordial versus consequent or something. But there is a difference between the two levels of wholeness, of which the second one is a greater level of complexity and beauty, which is awesome, you know. Oh
Well,
yeah,
this
I read
might
it.
be a good place to finish up for today, but I wanted to ask you, you're familiar with Matt Siegel's work on process philosophy?
Yeah.
Have you talked to him yet?
I haven't. Yeah,
Would you
I
be interested?
yeah, absolutely. I mean,
Okay,
I listened to his
I'll see
video.
if I can put that together. Because I think the two of you would have a lot of fun talking.
Yeah, I mean, it's an yeah, let's I would love to come on again, because we just touched the surface of this work.
Yeah, I got through two questions. I have a dozen questions here. I got through two
Yeah,
of them.
because everything, I try and bring everything, yeah, like, I try and bring a holistic interpretation, but time is something that we have, so we'll come on the show another time.
Yes. And how long is your sabbatical?
Yeah, I mean, right now it's for another couple months, and so
Okay,
I'm
so
just,
we could schedule some things this summer. Yeah.
yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, just focusing honestly on doing a lot of reading and trying to write more. I have a couple other things that I'm writing, and then one of the goals would be, you know, of course, socializing with people smarter than myself. So, you know, just socializing with scholars in the space and stress it, and meeting just like-minded individuals like yourself. I think it's always so rewarding to be able to talk about similar interests with folks. So,
Well,
and
so
I'm new
I
to I'm
want
new
to
to
also ask you if you're familiar with Richard Watson's theory of his new theory of life as a song.
Oh, I use that metaphor in some of this work, but I'm not familiar with it. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to send you a link to he lays the whole thing out. Unfortunately, it's 5 hour and a half videos, but they're well worth watching. And I don't know that I agree with him completely, but I think he's onto something in terms of his overall sense. He's a brilliant thinker, and I think you would really enjoy talking to him, but I wouldn't want to put the two of you together unless you knew what his theory was.
Makes sense,
So
yeah.
he's a kind of a conversational colleague of Michael Levin,
Okay.
but Richard Watson is more in the biology and computer science world.
That's awesome. And then for me, my goal also for listeners that are watching is to distill this into videos or bite-sized pieces, make it more digestible, and also engage in the public discourse a little bit. So just talking to folks in the space. So very much looking for this to be, you know, the first of what I hope is a collaborative exercise, leveraging, you know, the public idea, the public exchange of ideas to further explore these ideas.
Cool. Well, I'm gonna turn off the meeting, but why don't you stay on for just a second? I wanted to ask you one more thing. Okay.